Good morning, everyone.
All right. First case of the day, 061756, Kelly versus Philip Morris. And it's Mr. Frederick, is it?
Yes. Thank you, Judge Rovner, and may it please the court. The district court certified this appeal by plaintiffs for this court to resolve whether Philip Morris may invoke the federal officer removal provision of 28 U.S.C. 1442A over this purely state law case. In following the Eighth Circuit decision in Watson versus Philip Morris, the district court committed two egregious errors of law. First, the court applied the wrong legal test for deciding whether a private person is acting under a federal officer.
Let me just stop you for one second and ask you what the status is of the petition for certiorari in Watson. Has the Solicitor General filed a brief yet?
No, he has not, Your Honor.
And let me ask you something else. Would you favor asking the government to weigh in on this appeal as well?
Yes, we would. The Solicitor General, under the rules of the Supreme Court, is not given a specific time period for filing a brief when the court issues an order inviting the views of the Solicitor General. The Watson case was issued such an order in May. The government would typically file its brief at some point during the autumn, but the government is aware that this case is being argued today. The second error that the district court committed was that it greatly misapprehended and overstated the degree of regulation actually mandated by the Federal Trade Commission. That agency has no regulations governing cigarettes whatsoever and no rules mandating or marketing or directing the marketing of light or low-tar cigarettes at all.
Well, didn't the FTC essentially dictate how cigarette manufacturers could advertise the low-tar nicotine, and doesn't that amount to a substantial control over the manufacturer's advertising?
No. In fact, to the contrary, what Philip Morris is pointing to are two consent decrees issued to resolve consensually two different false forms of advertising against different manufacturers. And it is well settled that those FTC consent orders don't have the force of law. In fact, American Brands and American Tobacco, which were the two companies involved in that, said in the statement of the consent decree itself that they were not accepting any liability for any violation. Moreover, in those consent decrees, there's no definition of light or low tar at all. All the FTC was said, your comparison in the Carlton case in 1995, where the company said that if you smoked 10 packs of Carlton cigarettes, that was less tar than if you smoked one of a different brand. The FTC said that that was false and misleading because of the fact that the tests done by the cigarette companies have a different consequence when, as opposed to people actually smoking. So there are no FTC rules in this area at all.
But tell me this. Is there really any meaningful difference between requirements that the FTC directly imposes via rulemaking and self-imposed requirements that the industry adopts, because it'll be subject to rulemaking if it doesn't? The effect seems to be the same.
There is absolutely a difference, and there is an important legal difference. In the Bates versus Dow AgroSciences case, the Supreme Court looked at that very question in the context of preemption, and it held that where there is a requirement imposed by statute that induces a change, that isn't enough for preemption. It follows a fortiori that simply voluntary compliance, which is what Philip Morris is asserting here, where there is no legal standard or legal requirement in place, cannot be enough to dictate specific action.
Well, you know, these companies comply with industry agreements and consent decrees, even when they're not parties to those decrees, because they know they know that if they don't, the FTC will step in.
But the point here, Judge Rovner, is that there's no FTC definition of light or low tar. There's no definition or requirement that the FTC has imposed that directs the cigarette companies to market their products in any way. And if the legal standard is that voluntary agreement among industry participants that is not required by federal law is enough to allow a private enterprise engaged in solely private activity to remove a case from state court to federal court, there is virtually no industry in the United States that would not be able to invoke the federal officer removal provision. Here, the FTC has approximately 700 pages of regulations as to all kinds of industries, televisions, all sorts of consumer products, etc. Not a single page concerns the tobacco industry. And in fact, in 2002, Philip Morris affirmatively asked the Federal Trade Commission to have regulations on this topic because there were none in place. So it strains credulity, we submit, to take the argument that a mere voluntary action on Philip Morris's part is enough to remove a case under the federal officer removal statute. And that's particularly true in light of the history and purposes of that statute. In the City of Greenwood versus Peacock case, the Supreme Court addressed the parallel removal provision for civil rights actions. And in that case, private parties sought to invoke the federal officer removal provision, alleging that violations of the civil rights laws had been made in the Deep South. The Supreme Court said that was insufficient because drawing on the history of this removal provision, and the court did that in footnotes 17 and 20 of the court's decision, and I urge the court to study those footnotes because what the court there said was that the history of the federal officer removal provision stemmed from a line beginning in 1815 with a revenue statute that allowed revenue agents who were being hassled by state officials and allowed them to remove actions brought by state officials against them.
Now, would you agree that the federal officer statute is sometimes implicated by a contractual relationship?
Yes. And in that situation, Judge Rovner, which is quite different from this one, the government has contracted with a private party for the performance of something the government could do itself. And that is classically the in aid of or assisting a federal officer, which the court in the Peacock case and in the Willingham case made clear was the test for determining whether someone was acting under a federal officer.
So it doesn't only apply when there's a particular statute or regulation underlying the claim.
Well, in the contract case, Your Honor, there is...
Yes or no?
Yes. It does apply beyond just statutes and regulations, but in those government contractor cases, the government is contracting pursuant to statute, often pursuant to regulation, and they have a written contract with the private party pursuant to which the party is acting. That was the case in the Agent Orange case, the Winters case, which the Fifth Circuit decided.
So if it applies to government contractors, then could it apply to companies that signed agreements to self-regulate under threat of federal action?
I don't think it goes that far, and here's the reason why. Number one, there is no such thing in this case. But number two, even if there was, a voluntary agreement is like a consent decree, and the FTC enters into those all the time. And under well-settled FTC precedent, such agreements do not have the force of law. The Beatrice Foods case, which this court decided in 1976, it's at 420 F. Second, said that the FTC orders do not have the force of law. In the TransUnion case, the FTC itself said its consent orders for voluntary agreements do not have the force of law. And the whole point of the federal officer removal provision is that a person acting at the direction of the federal government is being impeded in his or her acts as a result of a state prosecution.
Let me ask you this. And so the bottom line, you contend that a private entity can only rely on the federal officer removal statute if it performed work for the federal government? Do you think it's only applicable in that circumstance?
Yes. It's the statute is worded, United States or agency or officer thereof, parenthesis, or any person acting under that officer. So it is most indisputably a federal officer. And Judge Williams, the history behind this makes that clear, because these revenue acts that were enacted in 1815 were a response to the New England states that were resisting the collection of revenues to help pay for the War of 1812.
And it got steamed up pretty well, too, during the great period of the Grand Experiment, when the agents were raiding stills get arrested by local authorities.
That's correct. And in the Civil War era and in the Civil Rights era, there have been different periods of time in our history, Judge Bauer, in which states have exerted an animus toward federal government action.
Well, I think that's going on as we stand here today, so go ahead.
Well, my point
the
is
the animus is pretty obvious.
My point is that there is no reason to think that there is any state animus against Philip Morris. This is in effect a preemption case that is dressed up in a different guise, with Philip Morris asserting that
I doubt whether there's a single state or entity in the United States that doesn't have an animosity towards the tobacco industry.
And the same is true of the United States, as Judge
true.
Kessler
that's
found.
And
for very
finish.
Good reason, Judge Bauer.
Well, as an old smoker, I can agree. Go ahead.
But the point here is whether or not Philip Morris
understand the point.
The requisites of the federal officer statute. And here, where you've got a purely private enterprise engaging in private commerce, where there are no federal laws, regulations, etc., what Philip Morris is attempting to argue is by the weight of sheer paper as to all sorts of FTC matters that are completely irrelevant to the allegations. And the last point that I'd like to leave you with before saving my time for rebuttal is that it is important to look at the nature
You're
of...
You're using it right now, you know.
Is to make the point that the complaint here asserts that there was fraud in the marketing of light and low-tar cigarettes to create the impression that they were healthier for the smoker. And there is nothing that the federal government has issued in the way of a rule or regulation mandating that Philip Morris market its cigarettes in the way that is charged in the complaint here with being fraudulent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frederick. Good morning, Mr. Wagner.
Good morning, Jeff. Just one second, if you don't mind.
Sure. Don't start the time yet. He's getting his papers. Ready?
Ready.
Okay.
May it please the court. The district court's decision applied settled law to a unique set of facts involving the FTC's express policy decision to encourage and direct the marketing of low-tar cigarettes. And as I listened to the argument of plaintiff's counsel and as I studied the briefs, it really occurred to me that I think the way this case hinges is on a single fact here that we really need to focus on, and that is whether or not the plaintiffs are correct in characterizing the FTC's conduct here as ordinary course monitoring the advertising of cigarettes and bringing Section 5 enforcement actions versus what the record shows, which is that the FTC stepped out and articulated a clear public health-based policy and then erected a tar and nicotine testing and advertising regime to give life to that policy.
Now, in what sense is Philip Morris compelled or required to use the labels light or low tar on its cigarettes? I understand your position that if you wish to use those terms, the FTC requires you to back them up with scientific data. But how does the use of these terms put the company on a par with a federal agent carrying out the business of the government?
Well, not only scientific data, but it has to be substantiated by FTC method results themselves. That's what the FTC directed in its 1967 enforcement policy that's been backed up by the exemplary cases of the 1971 American Brands Consent Order and the 1995 American Tobacco Consent Order, both of which were adopted after notice and comment, and as to both of which the FTC said it intended to direct industry or provide the industry with guidance so that they would have a limited safe harbor for advertising. You see,
isn't that the key guidance? So there was no mandate from the FTC to use those words?
See, here's where I think we're conflating two requirements of the federal officer removal statute. acting under and causal nexus, and they have to be separate. For acting under the federal government, there has to be specific direction and control, as the plaintiffs say, in order to assist the government in carrying out a specific federal objective. Here we have the Federal Trade Commission deciding that it wanted to encourage the development and production of low-tar cigarettes, and it wanted to provide consumers with a single standardized metric for them to identify those cigarettes and choose those cigarettes if they decided to continue to smoke. And the direction then was a mandatory FTC test method, running the test itself, which was unique in FTC history, delegating the test to the cigarette manufacturers, including Philip Morris, so that we were performing those tests on behalf of the FTC, publishing that data as official FTC data, requiring that we include those numbers in all of our advertising, and then carefully circumscribing the circumstances in which we could use lights or low-tar descriptors. And the FTC itself did define low-tar in its 1979 and 80 annual reports to Congress. And so using the descriptors, although those were not mandated by any particular directive, those are inextricably intertwined with the FTC test method and with those results. They can only be used if our cigarettes measure at 15 or less milligrams tar under the FTC method, which is the FTC's definition for low tar.
Well, why wouldn't your position lead to federal jurisdiction over all industries where there is close regulation and supervised testing by federal agency, like grade A meat?
Well,
that's the standard that's set.
For a couple of reasons. Okay. Number one, while there are many industries in which there are close regulations, those industries are not, they did not create a marketplace. In other words, here you have a federal agency stepping out and adopting a policy in which it itself wanted to create the marketplace in which we are going to compete. And so the FTC itself defined all of the rules and actually wanted to promote the development and marketing and the consumer choice of these cigarettes and developed all of its rules and regulations. That's far different than an agency which simply has regulations and various members of private industry develop products for their own commercial purposes and say, oh, by the way, does this meet a testing standard? This is a fundamentally different situation where the FTC stepped out.
Let's go into the amicus argument, because the amicus points out a number of industries that are more highly regulated than cigarette advertising is regulated by the FTC. And I, in reading that brief, I was wondering how you can distinguish cigarette advertising from the labeling and advertising standards that are required by automobile crash tests, fuel economy, drug labeling and manufacturing, medical device makers. I mean, the list seems rather large, and the regulations are even more formally promulgated than the consent decrees and industry agreements that Philip Morris is relying upon.
There was a large list of regulated industries, and let me raise a couple of points to that, Your Honor. One is that they were not raised in the context, in most cases, of 1442 cases. They were simply cases that identified regulated industries and identified regulations in the context of preemption cases or other cases, so they weren't addressing 1442 removal, which has another element. There has to be a causal nexus. So it's not enough to say that there is regulation. And in fact, we agree, mere participation in a regulated industry is not enough. A plaintiff would have to come forward, like the Kellys here, and specifically try to attach liability for the conduct that an industry participant takes pursuant to that federal direction and control. So the plaintiff's argument here is really highly speculative. And if I could add, before appearing here today, I made sure that I looked. I went and I looked at the electronic databases to see what's happened, because they say that we can expect a tidal wave of removals if there's an affirmance here. But it's been over a year since Watson was decided. We're not seeing any such tidal wave.
Maybe no one agrees with Watson.
No, there have been 19 cases that I was able to find since Watson has been decided where a private party has sought to remove under 1442A1. And in 5 of those cases, removal was affirmed. And in 14 of those cases, removal was denied. That's about a 26% success rate, which shows that I think that courts are able to distinguish between industries, distinguish between fact patterns, In fact, as the court in Watson pointed out, I think this was the district court, you know, there are so many federal agencies and such a wide array of regulatory regimes, there really isn't a one-size-fits-all formula. But the fact-specific test that's been comfortably applied for 60 years now is one the courts have been able to deal with.
Well, why shouldn't we limit the federal removal statute to instances where a private actor is essentially performing governmental work or acting as a proxy for the government? Wouldn't that be consistent with the statute's origins, which we discussed earlier, and lead to a clear rule?
No, I think it would just substitute one test for another. Right now, we have a test that looks for acting under to the specificity of the federal direction and control, and courts have been able to do that. There's nothing in the text that indicates that it has to be limited to an official function and enforcing federal law. Rather, as the plaintiffs point out at pages 7 and 11 of their brief, it's really one in which you look to whether or not a private party defendant is assisting a federal agency or officer with a function or a policy objective of the federal government, and that's what we have here, where the FTC set up its tar and nicotine testing and advertising regime, conducted the testing itself, and then directed the tobacco companies, including Philip Morris, to conduct that testing on their behalf, to report out the results, to include those results in advertising, and to link the descriptors to those results.
Mr. Wagner,
yes, ma'am.
You know, in the briefs, and I think today in your argument, you seem to be viewing, you know, this as an unprecedented regulation. And I'm wondering how that can be when it does not seem to apply to all cigarette manufacturers. Native Spirit completely ignores the so-called requirement to publish the official tar and nicotine numbers. And the FTC doesn't pursue enforcement, certainly doesn't seem to be pursuing enforcement. If the plaintiff sued Native Spirit, would Native Spirit be able to remove the case to federal court using the federal officer statute?
The answer to that question, Your Honor, depends upon an assumption that the plaintiffs are making that I don't think is true, and that is that the American Spirit brand never complies with or isn't a part of this regime. And as we pointed out in the brief, the FTC can choose to ignore sometimes those with minuscule market share such as this, but American Spirit, I do notice on their web advertising, includes the FTC method numbers. So we'd have to have a situation in which a company was not complying. But even then, Your Honor,
are you saying if there were 1,000 minuscule share companies out there, they could ignore? Is that what you're saying?
No, and I don't think the FTC would let them ignore it. I don't think that that's because that hasn't happened. And we're here, you know, whether or not Philip Morris had its conduct directed and controlled by the Federal Trade Commission isn't affected by whether or not American Spirit ran an ad without the numbers.
Can Philip Morris claim qualified immunity for acts it takes in accordance with these advertising and label regulations?
That's not the defense we raised. We raised the defenses of express and implied conflict preemption. I think the immunity defenses are, and I'm not an expert in immunity defenses, and we didn't raise it, so I haven't researched it. I don't want to overstate things just in case, but my suspicion from the limited contact I've had with the immunity defenses is that they have a more narrow application to those who are actually employees or direct agents of the government, and that's where I've encountered the immunity defense.
You know, the
and didn't
plaintiff
raise it here.
Challenged you to name a single requirement of federal law with which Philip Morris will be unable to comply, while at the same time, complying with the state law requirement on which the suit is based. And maybe I missed it, but I didn't see a response to that in your brief.
Well,
would
I think
you want to take up that challenge?
The response is the direct conflict that the Eighth Circuit and the District Court in Watson emphasized, that an attack on the descriptors and state law liability for the use of lights, which are based upon the FTC's testing method and the FTC's rules and so carefully circumscribed by the FTC, necessarily calls into question our compliance with the FTC's regulatory regime, and it calls into question the FTC's decisions to encouraged the development and marketing of cigarettes. The FTC's decision to adopt this test method with its known limitations. The FTC's decision to require that we conduct the testing on the FTC's behalf. The FTC's decision to limit the use of low tar and lights descriptors to those cigarettes that test out at certain levels, which means less than 15 milligrams. And there's no dispute that we did. Marlboro Lights have always tested at less than 15 milligrams tar.
Is it your contention that light is a like qualifying term?
Yes, it is.
Even though your own, it seems as if your own expert has refuted that explanation in another lawsuit?
No, he didn't. I'm the one that put him on in that lawsuit. He did not contradict that at all in the lawsuit. He acknowledged that there is no FTC requirement mandating the use of lights. But we've pointed out using the contemporaneous FTC documents, such as the annual reports, as well as the consent orders, the definitions and the circumscription of the use of those descriptors.
So pages 42 and 43 of the blue brief are in error?
No, I just don't think that those get to the point. I know exactly what you're referring to, Your Honor, but the FTC's, the bullet points that the plaintiffs refer to beginning at the bottom of page 42, the first one is that the FTC derives its authority from Section 5 of the FTC Act.
Right.
No dispute. The FTC has not placed into effect a formal trade regulation rule involving cigarette advertising. We agree, but we've dealt with voluntary versus involuntary in the briefing. The FTC hasn't adopted a trade regulation rule governing low-tar descriptors. Again, they're making a very specific point about a formal trade regulation rule. PMUSA's decision to use low-tar descriptors.
So there's no dispute about that one either?
About a trade regulation rule, that's correct. Okay. Now, we dispute whether or not our actions were taken under the direction and control of the FTC, as we've laid out, as I've argued here, but not a trade regulation rule. The decision to use low-tar descriptors was a voluntary act in the sense they weren't mandated by any trade regulation rule.
No dispute.
However, they were circumscribed by the FTC's enforcement policy, the FTC's definition of low-tar, and the two exemplary cases that were intended to provide industry guidance according to the FTC's own statements. The FTC lacks authority to require cigarette manufacturers to use low-tar and lights descriptors. I would disagree with that. If the FTC wanted to adopt a trade regulation.
I know you would disagree. Did your expert disagree? That's the question.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And he says the FTC has authority under Section 5.
So they've misstated your expert's testimony here.
I think they were a little aggressive with the description. I don't want to accuse anybody. And then they say that some tobacco companies don't disclose the tar and nicotine content. They cited one advertisement, but I think we've already addressed that. So I'm out of time.
Is there anything? I'll give you a couple more minutes if you have, and then I'll give you a couple more minutes if you have something that you think you really need to add or want to add. Because we've
say
been
that
pretty aggressive in our questioning today.
No, and I appreciate that, and I do like the back and forth.
Let me just ask you this. Could we distinguish this case from Watson on the ground that the plaintiffs here didn't challenge the FTC method for measuring tar and nicotine or the reporting of those numbers? Because the plaintiffs here challenge only the use of the word light in the advertising of cigarettes, right?
They challenge, yes, they call lights and lowered tar as deceptive because they say that was a representation about a certain amount of tar and nicotine, but Mr. Kelly got more. And that's why the answer to your question, Your Honor, is no. You cannot divorce the use of descriptors from the FTC's tar and nicotine testing and advertising regime. And the plaintiffs have put them directly at issue. At paragraph 3 of the complaint, they allege that the representations of lights were a representation that Mr. Kelly would receive certain amounts of tar and nicotine, but that he received more. And that's carried through in 3 Illinois Consumer Fraud Act counts against Philip Morris. And so just as the court held in Watson, both the district court and the Eighth Circuit, there's no way to divorce the two. An attack on the use of descriptors, even though not mandated by a specific trade regulation rule, necessarily calls into question the wisdom and enforcement and policy choices that the FTC has made. It is a direct and frontal attack on the FTC's tar and nicotine testing and advertising regime. For that reason, Your Honor, the district court in Watson was correct, the Eighth Circuit in Watson was correct, and the district court below was correct, and we urge you to affirm.
Do you have any idea of why the Solicitor General hasn't filed a brief yet?
My suspicion is that they're working on it. I know that in the ordinary course they sort of put out the memo to whomever might be interested. It might be taking some time. There was summer recess. I can't speak for them, and I don't want to. I don't know.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much,
Mr.
Your
Wagner.
Honor. Thank you for your time and attention.
How much extra time did we give? Two and a half. Will you add two and a half? Thank you.
Scott Beck is 5 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you. If the FTC had actually mandated any of the stuff that Mr. Wagner mentioned, there would have been no need for Philip Morris to affirmatively propose for rulemaking on the following subjects. And I'm reading from the appendix at page 856. Quote, the disclosure of average tar and nicotine yields of cigarette brands. Quote, the use of disclaimers with respect to average tar yield and the health effects of, quote, low-yield cigarettes, and, quote, the use of descriptors such as light and ultralight. They asked for the FTC affirmatively to propose rules because they wanted to know exactly what was mandated by the federal government. What he's asking you to opine on is that a statement made in some policy reports that the FTC made to Congress has the binding force of law that the cigarette industry, in taking whatever actions they want to take, are acting under the FTC. The absurdity of that position, I would point out, is belied by the fact that there are literally tens of thousands of notice and comment rules and regulations throughout the federal government that actually carry the force of law. These are not just policy pronouncements, but they are actually legal, mandated requirements that industry must follow on a vast array of very specific subjects. And if Philip Morris's theory is correct here, then virtually every regulated industry in America will be able to invoke far more serious regulations that are in effect than what Philip Morris asserts here.
Well, then answer Mr. Wagner's statement that, you know, we've got, what, 19 cases since Watson, and, you know, where's this house of horrors? Where's this Pandora's closet? Where's this?
You've got a window blinds manufacturer asserting to be a federal officer. You've got a medical device maker asserting to be a federal officer. You've got the railroads and the Eighth Circuit asserting to be a federal officer because of the supposedly extensive regulation of the Fair Railroad Safety Act. You've got industries that are already attempting to force the action, and I think in a decision by this court that would further encourage that development would cause an unleashing. Most of the cases, I think, are feeling out this unprecedented and unexpected development in the federal officer removal statute, and I think the signal that this court sends will be a profoundly important one. If I could go back to your question, Judge Rovner, about the expert here and read from the appendix at page 905, question, has the FTC ever proposed a trade regulation rule which would have required cigarette companies to use low-tar descriptors? Answer, I believe that would not be, again as a layman, the commission would not do it. Question, have they done it, I'm asking you? Answer, that's not within their authority to do. So the whole theory of this case, resting on the use of light descriptors, their own expert says it's not within the FTC's authority to mandate, and that is presumably why in 2002 Philip Morris asked the FTC to look at this. Footnote 17 of Philip Morris's brief concedes that there is no rule with respect to intra-brand comparisons. So all of the stuff that they're talking about with respect to testing and all of that misses the key point of what this case is about, which is that when Mr. Kelly began smoking Marlboro Lights, he did it on a false representation that cigarette was going to be better for him. And that's what this case is about. And there is nothing that the FTC has issued in the form of regulation, policy statement, or otherwise that goes directly to that claim. And all of the cases that have gone to federal officer removal have looked at a specific directive issued by the federal government that the private party has to comply with. And that directive is the fulcrum of the plaintiff's complaint. But that it cannot be the case here, as Philip Morris itself concedes. I see that my time has expired. I thank the court.
You have 1 minute.
Okay. Finally, let me conclude by saying one last point. It is an absurdity to think that for actions that the United States government itself is suing Philip Morris, their fraudulent use of descriptors, that the company can claim to be a federal officer for the very same acts. That makes no sense. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Frederick. Thank you very much, Mr. Wagner. And the court will take the case under advisement.